Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcasts at home is quite easy. You could use a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast, or it's simpler to use a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports and find advice for listening to shortwave at home. Please check out the website and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, France 24, and Radio Havana, Cuba. We will begin with Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. Monday was the 1-year anniversary of the Hamas attack in Israel, with actions taking place globally. Students at Columbia University, both pro-Israeli and pro-Palestinian, gathered and remembered the day from different perspectives. Israel continued its bombing of mosques and schools in Gaza, alleging that they were being used as Hamas command centers and killing civilians. The United Nations say that 90% of Gazans have been displaced multiple times. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
As Israel marked the 1-year anniversary of the October 7th attacks, students at Columbia University in New York staged demonstrations, some in support of Israel, others backing the Palestinian cause and protesting the war in Gaza. Columbia was the site of mass protests against the war earlier this year and touched off a wave of campus demonstrations around the United States. DW's Aya Ibrahim reports from New York.
Police, barricades, lines, and ID scanners. These are unusual measures for Columbia's campus, otherwise known for its openness to the public. But in the lead-up to October 7th, university leadership deemed them necessary for student safety.
Hashem, who will like him?
Bring them home!
Inside, protests and counter-protests. On one side of the divide, a pro-Israel demonstration.
Today is not about us here. It's really not. It's about our friends and family in Israel. It's about commemorating October 7th. We just wanted to find a way to honor the hostages, to remember the people that, you know, that were killed, and to raise awareness.
Separated by metal and public safety officers, others protest the war in Gaza those attacks triggered. They want their university to cut ties with companies linked to Israel.
And they are getting such explicit funding and support right now. We have a right to mourn. We have a right to be here. And we have a right to care about the people in Palestine.
These protests are some of the biggest on campus since the new academic year began last month. In the spring, dozens of students were arrested here amid protests calling for an end to the war in Gaza and for Columbia to divest from Israel. Protesters seized a building, and a student encampment was violently dismantled by New York City police. Today, an installation in memory of hostages killed and still held in Gaza stands in its place. The university's interim president visited the installation Monday morning. The experience of the spring has left a mark on the student body. Many pro-Palestinian demonstrators tell us they're afraid to show their faces, fearing retribution.
Everyone whose face has been exposed has been photographed. Many of us have ended up on doxing websites. My name is on several websites with incorrect information about me. And that is a huge risk for all of us. It also means that for me personally, I don't know if I'll ever be able to visit my loved ones in Palestine again because I have my name in that space and I'm doxxed in that way.
As the university hopes to avoid a repeat of the spring, students on both sides of the divide tell us a lot more needs to be done for there to be trust between them and their peers and for them to feel safe on campus.
the increased surveillance keeps us in such a dangerous position, and it's very hostile.
The people on the other side don't talk to me, but I just try to tell them that we are human and Jews should be allowed to grieve in peace.
A year on, the sides struggle to even find the basis for a conversation.
Let's cross over to our correspondent, Aya Ibrahim, who's at Columbia University in New York. Aya, what have protesters there been telling you?
Well, you certainly can't see it right now, David, but this was a much, much fuller campus this morning. But maybe you can hear some of the workers behind me dismantling some of the barricades that the university had put up to make sure that the two groups of protesters were at a safe distance from each other. I had a chance to speak to both the pro-Palestinian students here on campus and also those who were commemorating the October 7th attack on Israel. On the Palestinian side, I will say there was a lot of fear among the students, also fear from the media. It was actually quite a challenge to get somebody to speak to us on the record and give us their name, because there is that impression that their narrative and their story is twisted in mainstream media. They also had a lot of fear from doxing, from being identified, and then being either disciplined later by the university or, you know, that this could affect their career chances because they're associated with the Palestinian cause. Of course, as you mentioned, last year, Columbia was the epicenter of U.S. campus protests, and there had been arrests for students had been arrested, and some were suspended and put on probation. On the Israel, pro-Israel side, I mean, there is, of course, a lot of mourning, a lot of devastation at what this day brought to many of their loved ones and their families in Israel. But there's also, of course, a lot of disappointment and hostility towards their pro-Palestinian classmates for what they perceive. One student told me, for example, that, you know, he claims that his fellow students support, quote, terrorism. And so there's, you know, quite a divide between students here on this day, at least. On other days on campus, you can't really see it, but today it was very, very pronounced. One student that I met just in the lawn behind me, who was protesting, commemorating the October 7th attack, said, you know, we live in different worlds.
Really divided there. And those weren't the only protests in the U.S. Let's zoom out a little bit, though. Could protests like these have an impact on the U.S. elections, which are just less than a month away?
Well, you know, these campus protests are spread out across the country. Students, you know, on a specific campus don't typically come from that particular state, or they're not all from that particular state or that particular city. However, the debate around anti-Semitism and, anti-Palestinian rhetoric on college campuses has certainly sort of taken a life of its own in American political rhetoric. And we've seen, you know, former candidate Joe Biden and also the Republican nominee Donald Trump both sort of address this issue and try to spin the story in a way that would be appealing to their bases. So certainly, you know, I don't think it's going to really, you know, given the size of the protests that we've seen today, necessarily turn into what we've seen last year. But certainly what we've seen last year did have a massive space in American political discourse, with, you know, the candidates weighing in on the issue themselves. So it remains to be seen if that's something that we're going to see return with these protests.
DW's Aya Ibrahim there in New York. Thanks, Aya.
More than 20 people have been killed in Gaza in an Israeli airstrike on a mosque and a former school. The Hamas-run Gaza Media Office said 93 other people were injured in the attack that took place early Sunday morning in the central town of Deir al-Balah. It said the school was being used to shelter displaced people. Israel says the two facilities were Hamas command centers. DW correspondent Tanya Kramer joins me from Jerusalem. Tanya, what more do we know about the overnight strikes on Gaza and Israel's current military campaign in the Strip?
Well, it's certainly a reminder that the war in Gaza is continuing at full force. Now, the Israeli military has confirmed that they struck those two areas in Deir al-Balah, which is in the middle area of Gaza, where a lot of Gazans have fled and sought shelter in this area. Tens of thousands are believed to be in this area. Now, the military confirmed that it struck a mosque and a former school in Deir al-Balah. They are saying that it had targeted as a Hamas command and control center, and as they usually say, that Hamas and other militant groups are embedding themselves in civilian areas without providing further evidence of that. We understand from health authorities there that some of the victims there are still under the rubble. Now, the Israeli army has also said that they are relaunching a ground operation in Jabalia, which is in the northern part of the Gaza Strip. Jabalia is in the north of Gaza City. We've seen multiple times the army going into that area where they have been before. They're saying now that Hamas and other militant groups there are regrouping or are trying to reinstall their military structure there. That is what the military is saying. And residents that are remaining in the north, they're not that many. The United Nations believe there are over 200,000 in northern Gaza. They have been called upon by the Israeli military to move south. The military said they have expanded what they call a humanitarian zone, and people should be moving there. But that means, again, that people are, again, if they follow this this order, they are again on the move. We know that people in Gaza have been multiple times displaced, with the United Nations estimating that about 90% of Gaza's population has been displaced by now.
DW's Tanya Kramer in Jerusalem.
Those reports were from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com, as well as on YouTube at their channels called DW News and DW Documentary. They are also available at most podcast sites, as is the shortwave report. Next, France 24. First, an Israeli press review from October 7th. Then a press review from the Independent UK, which presented a front page with facts and figures from the war on Palestine, followed by some other international press reviews. Finally, an interview with Ahmed Benchemsi, a communications director at Human Rights Watch, on the treatment of Palestinian detainees in Israeli prisons. Human Rights Watch says that it is a war crime. France 24.
We're going to take a look now at how this anniversary is being viewed in the international newspapers. Leo McGuinn joins us in studio for that. Leo, let's start with the Israeli newspapers.
Of course, as you imagine, Eve, this is very much the only story in the Israeli press this morning. I'll start with the Jerusalem Post, quite a poignant front page from them. They have a blank page, no pictures, barely any words. They read, 1 year on, words still fail to capture the horrors of that day. I'll move next to Israel Hayom, which is the country's most read newspaper. You can see their front page there. They accompany with various images from this day last year. A very simple headline, 1 year on. The pictures there show some of the hostages, some images of Hamas perpetrating the attacks. The 24 hours that changed everything, they call it. Haaretz have a slightly different tone this morning on their front page. They still have that line, 1 year on, but they surmise that Israel is stuck with no end in sight. Inside the paper this morning, they have this two-page spread highlighting the individual stories of October the 7th, the enduring memory of the horror, they call it. They talk to some who survived the massacre, including one woman at the Nova Music Festival whose friend was shot and died right beside her. Also, Tammy Metzer, who was abducted and held for 53 days in captivity before being released. case, but her husband was killed. A surgeon is also interviewed. She talks about the hours of operating in the aftermath and the horrors that she saw. There's actually an interesting survey in Haaretz this morning. They spoke to 1,000 people. 53% of that number said that the war should be ended. That breaks down to 45% of Jews surveyed and a whopping 93% of Arab respondents. Most of the respondents cited the risk that the fighting poses to the Israeli hostages Hamas are still holding in Gaza, as well as a need to focus on battling Hezbollah on the northern front. Start with the Independent in the UK. They have this very busy front page with a lot of facts and figures. 1,205, that's the number of people killed on October the 7th, according to Israeli tallies. 41,870, that's the number of Palestinians killed in Gaza, according to Gaza's health ministry. 31 out of 36 hospitals in the enclave have been damaged or put out of service. More than 10,000, that's the amount of one-ton bombs sent by the US to Israel in that time since October the 7th. And 66%, that's the percent of buildings that have been damaged across the Gaza Strip. That's just a few of the statistics that make up the Independent front page this morning. Many of the UK papers are focusing on Emily Damari, including The Mirror, who have her on their front page. She's the only British hostage that's still being held captive. Her mum puts out a plea in this morning's paper, making an emotional plea for her daughter's return. Well, let's cross the channel to France next. This is Aujourd'hui en France, the day that never ends, they call it. 1 year on, the country remains haunted by the attacks. Now the whole region from Gaza to Lebanon is feeling the repercussions. Libération have this striking image on their front page from Nova Music Festival, a terrified woman fleeing the attacks, the headline evoking what they call the region tumbling into a bloody cycle of reprisals.
Now we're going to bring you today's perspective guest. And Amnesty International says there have been horrifying cases of torture and degrading treatment of Palestinian detainees with a failure to investigate incidents in custody. Human Rights Watch says Israeli forces have published degrading photographs and videos of detained Palestinians, including children. Just two reports released saying the cases are unacceptable, inevitably, of course, and more needs to be done to prevent them. Well, we're going to discuss the latest now with Advocacy and Communications Director for the Middle East at Human Rights Watch, Ahmed Benjamzi. Thanks very much for joining us on the programme today. What evidence, then, do you have that this abuse is going on?
Well, first we have figures, you know, and I'm talking about Israeli official figures. According to those, as of October 1st, I mean like 10 days ago, there are 10,000 Palestinians in Israeli detention facilities, including 3,500 administrative detainees. Now, what does that mean, administrative detainee? It is a system, and I'm telling you just like official information for now. We'll get to the torture later. But administrative detention is a system that allows the Israeli military to detain a person without charge or trial, and in which the detention can be renewed indefinitely based on what? On secret information, which neither the detainees nor their lawyers are allowed to see. In other words, administrative detainees are held on the presumption that they might commit an offense at some point in the future. Under that system, the Israelis are holding children, human rights defenders, and political activists for civil society. And so as per the pictures that you mentioned, yes, we did analyze several posts published by Israeli forces media outlets depicting captured Palestinians stripped to their underwear, handcuffed, blindfolded and injured with humiliating captions by Israeli soldiers. This is a form of inhumane treatment that amounts to a war crime. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. I can tell you about the deaths under custody and physical torture, if you ask me.
What would you say to people who say there's a war going on, this kind of thing is inevitable?
This kind of thing is a violation of international law. This kind of thing is a war crime. So if they say that war crimes is inevitable, those who say that war crimes are inevitable don't believe in human rights. They don't believe in justice. They don't believe in accountability. We do.
How can you deal with accountability, though, when there is a war going on? When people are focused perhaps on their own loved ones, on what's going on in individual countries?
This level of administrative detainees predates October 7th. It predates the war. I'm talking about 10,000 prisoners now. There were 5,000 before October 7th. You know, not everything started on October 7. It's been 75 years, and it's been the occupation has lasted for 50 years, and we have documented countless human rights abuses by the Israeli regime. We can call it that, as applied to Palestinians. It's an apartheid regime. So the war is not a justification. This stuff started way before the war.
We also had in the summer, didn't we, the arrest of 10 Israeli soldiers after the brutal rape of a Palestinian prisoner that was caught on video.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's good that there is some measure of accountability, but it is way insufficient. And we have also documented efforts by Israeli lawmakers to avoid accountability, actually, on their troops. The arrests of Israeli soldiers for abusing Palestinians are very rare. From 2017 to 2021, less than 1%, specifically 0.87% of the complaints against Israeli soldiers led to prosecutions. So don't tell me about accountability. It's largely insufficient.
Yeah, do you see any efforts from Israel at all to bring people to justice? I mean, there was, wasn't there, the case of a reservist who was dismissed for conduct didn't represent the Israeli forces' values, they said?
I actually see the opposite of that. Israel's justice minister criticized the detaining for questioning of soldiers. He said that they were performing, and I quote him, a holy job. The Israeli finance minister and the national security minister both tweeted, hands off our reservists, as a reaction to the investigation of that soldier who was being investigated for abuse. The Knesset's defense committee chair wrote mentioned on social media this, and I quote him, despicable pursuit of our fighters. These are top-level Israeli government and Knesset officials. So obviously, not only are they not pursuing accountability, but they are actively sabotaging it.
Do you see that it happens from both sides? I mean, let's not forget the hostages, of course, who were taken from Israel by Hamas into the Gaza Strip.
Of course, detaining hostages is absolutely unacceptable, and we have called for their release immediately, and we have called, Hamas did on October 7 a war crime. But a war crime on one side absolutely does not justify a war crime on the other side and in epic proportions. And I'm also talking about war crimes that were committed before October 7. So, yeah, it's not because, you know, bad stuff is done on one side that you can do bad stuff and even worse stuff, you know, if we compare the numbers, on the other side. One harm doesn't justify another.
Thanks very much for joining us, Ahmed Benchemzi, Middle East Director at Human Rights Watch. Thanks very much.
Those press reviews and interview are from France 24, which may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English. They're also available at most podcast sites. If you have questions or comments about the Shortwave Report or can help support this program, like continuing supporters from Utrecht, Netherlands, and New York City, there's a link for online donations available at my website, outfarpress.com, or you could write to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Many, many thanks to everyone who's ever helped keep this freely distributed show airborne. Please join the gang. And if you're listening to a public radio station, please help support them as well. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. French President Macron has called for an arms embargo on Israel. Israeli forces killed Hassan Hamad, a 19-year-old Palestinian journalist, in a targeted assassination. Radio Havana, Cuba.
French President Emmanuel Macron has called for an arms embargo on the Israeli regime over the latter's ongoing genocidal war against the Gaza Strip, promoting a fiery backlash from the regime's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. I think that today the priority is that we return to a political solution that will stop delivering weapons to fight in Gaza, Macron said in an interview released on Saturday, which have been recorded earlier this week. I think we're not being heard, he noted, describing the regime's determination to press on with the war as a mistake. Netanyahu denounced the call for the embargo as a disgrace, alleging that the regime was defending itself on seven fronts against the enemies of civilization. Concomitantly with the war, the regime has been waging a hugely deadly escalation against Lebanon, as well as intensifying attacks on the occupied West Bank, Syria, and Yemen. as vilified countries should be standing firmly by Israel's side as the regime is waging the aggression, the Israeli Prime Minister claimed. Netanyahu also alleged that the regime was waging the atrocities for the sake of peace and security in the world, adding that it would keep up the aggression until the battle is won. He also claimed that the regime would emerge victorious with or without the support of its allies. Reacting to Netanyahu's retort, Macron's office assured the regime that France was a steadfast friend of Israel. Paris continued its armed support for the regime after it lost its war on Gaza. Although under the armed trade treaty signed by the country in 2014, the French government was obliged to suspend its weapon exports to the regime upon becoming aware that military attacks were directed against the people of the coastal sliver. Led by the United States and Germany, the regime's allies have supplied it with millions of dollars worth of weapons since the onset of the war. Israeli forces have killed Palestinian journalist Hassan Hamad in an airstrike on his home in northern Gaza's Jabalia refugee camp, days after the slain journalist said he was warned by an Israeli officer to stop filming in Gaza. With the killing of the 19-year-old journalist, whose work appeared on Al Jazeera and other networks, the number of Palestinian journalists killed since the war began has raised into 175, according to Gaza's government media office. The Committee to Protect Journalists says at least 128 journalists and media workers are among the more than 41,000 people killed since Israel launched the devastating war in Gaza in October 2023. Colleagues and the government's media office in Gaza confirmed Hamad's death, saying the journalist's home was deliberately attacked to silence him after he received threats. Hassan Hamad, the journalist who did not live past the age of 20, resisted for a full year in his own way. He resisted by staying away from his family so they wouldn't be targeted. He resisted when he struggled to find an internet signal, sitting for an hour or two on the rooftop, just as on the videos that reach you in seconds. A post on Hamas X account posted by his colleague said, at 6 a.m., he called me to send his last video. After a call that didn't last more than a few seconds, he said, there they are, there they are, it's done, and hung up, the colleague added. According to footage verified by Al Jazeera, Hamad's body was found in pieces and had to be put into bags and boxes after the Israeli attack. This is what remains of his body, one of his colleagues shared in an Instagram post. Hamad had been documenting Israel's war in Gaza for more than a year and worked as a freelancer TV reporter. Palestinian journalist Maha Hussaini said that a few days before Hamad's death, he had been threatened by an Israeli officer through a WhatsApp message and several calls, ordering to stop filming in Gaza.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working well at radiohc.cu. No podcast, however. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140 and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6000, 6060, or 6100. At their website, radiohc.cu, you can stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific Daylight Saving Time. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You will have to look even harder these days because of U.S. and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find information for online donations. There's a link at my website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. This shortwave report, which is now in its 28th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. For 27 years, the shortwave report has been produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm still recuperating from a spinal injury, so I'm staying in a house that's connected to the grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.